In Houston, Texas, six migrants died in an SUV after being chased by police through rainy weather in 2019. Advocates have long said that those episodes illustrate the risk that migrants are willing to take to access the United States and leave behind uncertain lives in their native lands. The Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Texas Governor Greg Abbott quickly blamed President Biden for the most recent deaths in San Antonio. Governor Greg Abbott said, "These deaths are on Biden. They are a result of his deadly open border policies. They show the deadly consequences of his refusal to enforce the law." The condemnation of the president comes after members of the Texas GOP criticized Democrats such as gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke for calling for more meaningful gun control measures after the shooting deaths of 19 children and two of their teachers at a school in Uvalde, Texas. Following the tragic news from San Antonio, Beto O'Rourke echoed calls for expanding avenues for legal migration to discourage human smuggling rings responsible for organizing such dangerous trips across the U.S.-Mexico border.
Midstream.
Fourth year since the establishment of the temporary Israeli entity on the land of occupied Palestine after its invasion of its land in 1948 comes amid a state of existential threat that Israeli officials are now touching more realistically. The reason for this is not only because of the new coalition known as the Al-Quds Axis and its accumulation of enough power to liberate Al-Quds, but also because of Jewish history and dogmas which testify that this entity, in the words of one of the entity's most important founders, David Ben-Gurion, doomed to perish, and it is only a matter of time. The Zionist concern about the annihilation of the state emerged in the speech of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who stated that a sovereign and united Jewish state has not held on to this land for more than 80 years, the decade we never crossed in the past, recalling the experience of the two previous Jewish kingdoms, the first being the Kingdom of David and Solomon, according to the claims of the occupying entity, which lasted 80 years, and the Hasmonean Kingdom that lasted 79 years. Bennett's statement comes as the second official statement that seriously addresses the idea of demise during the past 5 years. He was preceded by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who in turn said in 2017, "I will strive to make Israel reach its 100th birthday, a state for the Jewish people for more than 80 years." In 2017, the Israeli writer Ari Shavit published an article in the Hebrew newspaper Haaretz under the title "Israel Breathes Its Last," in which he explained the deception practiced by this entity regarding its presence on the land of Palestine, where he said, "Since the Israelis came to Palestine, they realized they are the result of a lie invented by the Zionist movement. Through exploiting and exaggerating what was called the Holocaust by Hitler, the movement was able to convince the world that Palestine is the promised land and that the alleged temple is located under the mosque." Shavit also spoke of the illusions that Jewish institutions sell about the origins of Jews in the land of Palestine, saying, "If Israeli and Judaism are not a vital factor in identity, then it is over. Friends must bid farewell, moving on to San Francisco or Berlin. From there, from the countries of the new German ultranationalism or the countries of the new American ultranationalism, one must look calmly and watch the state of Israel breathe its last." The curse of lying is what persecutes the so-called Israelis, and day after day slapping them on their faces in the form of a knife in the hand of a Maqdisi, Khalili, and Nablusi, or with a collective stone or a bus driver from Jaffa, Haifa, and Acre. It was never a land without a people. They lied. After 74 years, the Israelis have unwillingly realized that they have no future in Palestine. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Perhaps during the years of its occupation of Arab lands in Palestine and elsewhere, Israel was not waiting to pass through a situation similar to what it is going through these days in terms of weakness, humiliation, hesitation, and fear for the future and fate. It is true that it, like any occupier or aggressor, always puts within its calculations under pressure and with the aim of absorbing a specific situation, the possibility of relinquishing some gains or accepting an inappropriate settlement for it. However, for Israel today to reach a situation where it has begun to see the possibility of its demise or its defeat from our region, as per the words of its own leaders, is greater than the possibility of its persistence in its occupation. This is what was not waiting for or thinking about in any of the leaders of the occupation. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hassan Hijazi, editor and expert on Zionist affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hijazi. Now, in a message marking the one-year anniversary of his government, we heard the Zionist Prime Minister Naftali Bennett saying Israel is facing a real test and it is witnessing an unprecedented situation that is close to the collapse and facing a historical crossroads. Now, indeed, Israel has in the past year alone been dealt with several blows. Which of those blows do you think made Bennett feel maybe the heat of the situation?
The issue is related to the internal political dilemma and the current divisions inside Israel. These divisions were signals that were touched by Naftali Bennett and was even mentioned before by Ehud Barak and the former director of Mossad. They both spoke about a catastrophic position which the occupation is heading to. This indicates that this occupation is facing the risk of demise. Ehud Barak spoke about the dilemma of the eighth decade of the Zionist entity's existence. So did Tamir Pardo, the former director of the Mossad, who claimed that Israel has activated the self-destruction devices. All this is a result of the internal Israeli disunity and divisions, and the inability of the Zionist regime to formulate a cabinet and agree upon a unified vision concerning most of the entity's local files. Added to that, the external challenges that Israel is facing, which includes the crisis with the Palestinian natives, Saif al-Quds battle, and the clashes that followed it, alongside the regional challenges presented by the continuous head-to-head struggle against the Islamic Republic in Iran and the axis of resistance. All of the above predicts a change in the strategic balance of power in the region, which represents a serious and existential risk for this entity. All these indicators urged Naftali Bennett to sound all his alarms, stressing that the Zionist entity is facing an existential threat related to our security, our unity, and our ability to persevere in the face of challenges throughout the periods to come.
Well, Mr. Hijazi, the current Israeli government was formed on June 13 of last year with a slim majority of 61 votes out of the 120 Knesset votes. This majority soon was lost inside of the Knesset, and now Bennett's government has only 60 votes left. The opposition is striving to bring down the government by trying to track down one more vote from within the deputies in the ministerial coalition of Naftali Bennett, which would bring it down most definitely immediately. If the opposition succeeds in doing so, what change do you think will undergo within the regime of the Zionist entity?
There is the issue of resorting to early elections inside Israel, and this is what many Israeli political leaders are seeking at the moment. However, this issue clashes with desire to certain Zionist political blocs, who would rather see the current coalitions remain as is inside the Knesset. They would rather see a new cabinet being formed headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. In case Netanyahu actually succeeds in persuading some of the Knesset members who are part of the current Bennett coalition to persuade them to join the opposition and choose Netanyahu as their new prime minister so as to formulate a new government. This issue on its own confirms that the current political strife in Israel is not going anywhere anytime soon. In the event the government continues to be supported by a minority, or else the only option left would be an early election, which, to be honest, will not bring real solutions to the table, as long as the balance of power remains as is inside Israel. As per the poll results, which does not present any party with a majority that would allow them to formulate a government, this is an indicator that the Zionist entity is facing a serious political crisis, and that this level of disunity will prevent the formation of a stable government capable of implementing the entity's policies and approve government programs, or one that is capable of generating real stability at the level of politics and society.
Well, we did hear a lot of the opinion polls published by the Zionist newspaper Israel Hayom last month, which showed 69% of settlers fear of the fate of their occupation entity, and also showed that 66% of those settlers do not trust the Israeli occupation police. With such a lack of optimism in a large proportion of Zionists about their future, and we are looking at a possible social rift within the occupation society. If that happens, might that bring the entity down to its knees without the need for an all-out regional war to get the occupation out of Palestine?
This issue represents one of the major challenges that the Zionist entity is currently facing at multiple levels. The entity is suffering from several internal divisions. It suffers from structural crisis at the economic and social level. There are deep fractures between the Zionist right and the Zionist left, between the religious Zionists and the secular ones, between the Eastern Zionists and the Western ones, between the native Arabs and the Zionist settlers, which represents ticking time bombs, which in the event it all explodes would lead to the disintegration of this entity. Yes, these risks have been presented by many experts in the Zionist affairs, especially the Israeli ones, who believe that the internal disunity represents a way more serious existential threat than the wars waged by Israel and the external challenges the entity is facing. Israel is facing serious security threats, even nuclear threats, as well as per its own experts. Therefore, these risks can simply be a foundational basis in weakening this entity and pushing it to lose many positions of power. Internal unity and the harmony between the internal components has become a missing factor for the existence of this entity. Without this unity, as Naftali Bennett said, then Israel will cease to exist and will fail in the face of the regional storms headed its way.
Mr. Hassan Hijazi, editor and expert on Zionist affairs, I want to thank you very much for being with us and for contributing to explain to us, to educate us about how the Zionist entity will be inflicted with its own consequences within its own societies. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about the media frenzy within Israel concerning Hezbollah's arsenal.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Israeli media are talking about the upcoming war with the Lebanese resistance and are afraid of Hezbollah's arsenal of missiles and their huge number. Fear is justified, as Hezbollah's arsenal of missiles and their sheer number make them a deadly tool against the Israeli enemy. It is estimated that on the eve of the 2006 war, Hezbollah had 15,000 rockets and fired about 4,000 rockets towards the occupation. In contrast, the resistance today has more than 100,000 missiles, according to Israeli security officials, and not the resistance. Now, Israel fears Hezbollah's missile arsenal in this following report.
Israeli media has been paranoid recently, not missing a chance to highlight what they call the upcoming war with the Lebanese resistance, with the reports that reflect fear of Hezbollah's large number of missile arsenal. Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv, for example, published a report on the growing strength of the Lebanese Hezbollah earlier this month, in which it said that the arsenal of Hezbollah's missiles that the Israeli occupation army will face in the next war is not to be underestimated. The following is the text of the Ma'arif report translated into English. Fear is justified, as Hezbollah's arsenal of missiles and their sheer number make them a deadly tool against the Israeli home front. It is estimated that on the eve of the Second Lebanon War, Hezbollah had 15,000 rockets and fired about 4,000 rockets towards the north. In contrast, the organization today has more than 100,000 missiles, according to Israeli security officials. Hezbollah's surface-to-surface missile array consists mostly of Russian-made Katyusha missiles. According to the Missile Threat website, these missiles have a warhead of up to 20 kilograms and a range of 40 kilometers. Analysts in the West estimate that the Katyusha constitutes most of Hezbollah's missile force. The Lebanese resistance also possesses Iranian-developed Fajr missiles, as the Fajr 3 missile has a range of 43 kilometers and carries an explosive head weighing 45 kilograms, in addition to the more advanced Fajr 5, which has a range of up to 75 kilometers and has an explosive head of 90 kilograms. It is noteworthy that the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, gave a speech last February in which he said, "We have the ability to make thousands of missiles accurate." Nasrallah added, "The Israeli enemy is trying to prevent advanced weapons from reaching Lebanon by targeting shipments in Syria. We are fully capable of transforming our missiles to make them accurate. We have been doing this for years." Not to mention the Ra'ad 2 and Ra'ad 3. There is also in the arsenal the Iranian version of the Russian missile Frog 7, and it has the ability to shoot deep into occupied Palestine. The Missile Threat website reported that Hezbollah and Iran are working to improve the accuracy of these advanced missiles, and the result is the upgraded Zilzal version. The Zilzal 1 missile has a range of 125 to 160 kilometers and has an explosive warhead of 600 kilograms. And Zilzal 2 is considered more advanced with a range of 210 kilometers and a similar warhead of 600 kilograms. Hezbollah's missile arsenal also includes the Fateh 110, an Iranian short-range ballistic missile that appears to be a different version of the Zilzal 2. The missile has a range of 250 to 300 kilometers, making it a long-range weapon in Hezbollah's inventory. It has a warhead of up to 500 kilograms and is GPS-guided. According to reports in Western media, Iran provided such missiles to Hezbollah as early as 2007. On July 12, 16 years will have passed since the war that broke out in 2006. Since then, the northern Palestinian border has witnessed security incidents, but it has remained relatively calm. However, the possibility of the situation erupting again remains.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Hussein Rahal, professor of sociology at the Lebanese University. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor Rahal. Now, recently, the Zionist media have been presenting a lot of reports about the arsenal of the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah, where one of the reports says, and I quote, "While the interception system, arrows, magic wand, and iron dome provide an effective response to heavy fire from the Gaza Strip, it is difficult to achieve similar results in the event of a war with Lebanon, or an outbreak of multiple front wars that will witness the launching of thousands of missiles simultaneously from Lebanon, Gaza, and Syria, without mentioning Iraq or Yemen. What is the point of repeating such scenarios for the settlers to hear inside of Israel?"
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Israel is facing a real challenge when it comes to Hezbollah's arsenal that might be launched from Lebanon in the event a war breaks out. These challenges are of three dimensions. First, these missiles being precise ones. Second, these missiles have grave destructive power. And third, the large number of missiles in the hands of the resistance. These three dimensions pose a serious challenge for all the missile interception systems, which you mentioned above. The Israelis want to prepare the internal front and their settlers to be ready for any upcoming war, because the losses will be significant. The damage in the Israeli infrastructure will be significant. Besides preparing the settlers, Israel is also inciting the regional states against Lebanon and crafting a political and media cause in order to further demonize Hezbollah at both the international level and locally inside Lebanon, in order to push the public opinion against the Lebanese resistance, claiming that Hezbollah will be the one to be held responsible in the event a war breaks out in the region or in Lebanon. Therefore, this media frenzy has many goals: internal Israeli ones, internal Lebanese ones, and regional and international ones.
Well, it seems that the enemy is approaching a crossroad that it will force it to reconsider its policy simply because it could not curb Hezbollah's effort to establish independent production lines to improve the accuracy of the resistance missiles. I'm talking here about the precision missile project, which Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah multiple times spoke about. Is this evidence of the inevitability of a close war that might happen between the two sides?
Not necessarily, no. Maybe the issue is a bit different than what you just presented. We observed that there is some sort of an Israeli adaptation with respect to the developing military capabilities of Hezbollah. This can be observed when the Israeli entity upped the ante several times by claiming that it will strike Lebanon if and when balance breaker weapons find their way to Hezbollah. The balance breaker weapons did arrive, and still the Zionist entity remained silent. Later on, Israel claimed that if only tens of precision missiles find their way to Hezbollah, then definitely they will strike. Hezbollah leadership announces that it now possesses scores and scores of precision missiles, and that there even exists a local production line for some of these missiles inside Lebanon. We saw that Israel yet again adapted to this change in the balance of power. Hence, Israel's conviction in the presence of such kind of quality weaponry from precision missiles or whatnot. Hence that the occupation fears the consequences of kick-starting a war with the Lebanese resistance, which means that this approach simply increases the deterrence power of the Lebanese resistance, which would in turn prevent the actual ignition of a war. However, no one can really guarantee that Israel won't act in a reckless way, or that its occupation forces won't commit tactical mistakes in any part of our region that would lead towards a war unintentionally, even by Israel itself.
Well, Dr. Rahal added to the fear that the Zionist entity is having concerning Hezbollah's arsenal. We have the Israeli army suffering from many problems, most notably the decline in the status and the capabilities of the ground forces, the lack of training for reserve units, and a gap in the general staff's understanding of the citizens' position, the settlers' position inside of the occupied Palestine, which in turn leads to a decline in public confidence with that army on the ground. In this case, is the Israeli Air Force sufficient to stop the barrage of missiles that might, at the end of the day, fall on the Israeli entity from the Lebanese side?
Of course, the Air Force is not enough with evidence presented in the 2006 July war on Lebanon. Back then, Dan Halutz, the former chief of staff of the Israeli occupation forces, presented the U.S. military strategy, which is based on tactical superiority, just as we saw it being used by the U.S. against Yugoslavia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, in a way that this strategy is based on resolving the battle using solely the Air Force power. However, the July 2006 war confirmed the complete failure of this strategy. This prompted both Israel and the U.S. to develop their military training strategies.
But we did see them using it in Saif al-Quds, and they failed there too.
Yes, for sure. They also depended on air force power during Saif al-Quds in Gaza in May 2021, but it also failed. This is why they are attempting now to develop ground forces, which brought about the latest military drill, which took place in Cyprus, with the sole aim of enhancing the Israeli ground forces. Israelis claim that if they do not engage in a ground incursion towards the areas from which Hezbollah's missiles are being launched from, then for sure they will be able to stop the ongoing battle or at least score a certain form of victory. This is why, in no way possible, Israel will plan a war without utilizing its ground forces. This reality increases Israel's fear from failure and from incurring losses, simply because an air battle without a ground incursion will make it impossible for Israel to win the war against Hezbollah.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hussein Rahal, professor of sociology at the Lebanese University, for being with us and explaining how things will happen in the event of a war between the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, and the Israeli entity. Thank you for being here. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Climate change is to blame for the majority of the heat waves being recorded around the planet, but the relation to other extreme events and their impacts on society is less clear, according to a new study. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sophia Quaglia. The piece is titled Climate Change Role Clear in Many Extreme Events, but Social Factors Also Key, study finds. Climate change is to blame for the majority of heat waves being recorded around the planet, but the relation to other extreme events and their impacts on society is less clear, according to a new study. I think on the one hand, we overestimate climate change because it's now quite common that every time an extreme event happens, there is a big assumption that climate change is playing a big role, which is not always the case, said Friedrich Otto, a climate change and environment professor at the Grantham Institute at Imperial College, University of London, who was one of the lead authors of the new research. But on the other hand, we really underestimate those events where climate change does play a role in what the costs are, especially the non-economic costs of extreme weather events to our societies. In the study published in the journal Environmental Research, Climate from IOP Publishing, Professor Otto's team used attribution science to pore over available international data, literature and climate models, as well as the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, and calculate how human-induced climate change is affecting the impact of five types of extreme weather events: heat waves, heavy rainfall, drought, wildfires and tropical cyclones. They say that in the case of heat waves, the role of climate change is unequivocal, and that the average and extreme heat levels in every continent across the globe are increasing specifically because of human-caused climate change. A heat wave with a 1 in 50 chance of happening in pre-industrial times is now almost 5 times more likely to happen and will be 1.2 degrees Celsius hotter, according to an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. In the past 20 years, there have been 157,000 deaths from 34 heat waves, according to data from the MDAT disaster database. Yet the impact of human-induced climate change on heat waves and the repercussions are still largely underestimated. One big reason why we underestimate heat waves so dramatically is because no one's dropping dead on the street during a heat wave, or at least very few people do, Professor Friedrich Otto said. Most people died from pre-existing conditions suddenly becoming acute, Professor Otto added, and this often did not show up in data. Wildfires were also one of the big climate impacts not talked about enough, Professor Otto added. For other events such as droughts, floods, and tropical cyclones, there is a more nuanced link to climate change. For example, there are some regions of the world where droughts are becoming worse because of human-caused climate change, such as southern Africa, Professor Otto notes, while in other droughts, the climate change signal is either not there or very small. By focusing too much on climate change, it really takes the responsibility, but also the agency, away to address these local drivers of disasters, such as high poverty rates, missing infrastructure, investment, missing healthcare system, all these aspects of exposure and vulnerability that make every drought a catastrophe, Professor Otto said. That will not go away even if we stop burning fossil fuels today. I think that that is why the overestimation of climate change, by basically blaming this all on climate change, is not very helpful for actually dealing with and for actually improving resilience to these threats. Much of the problem in figuring out exactly to what extent climate change was responsible for the impact of extreme weather events, Professor Otto said, lay in the lack of reliable data around the globe. There is not enough information coming from lower and middle-income countries, although these are the places more likely to be at risk of the repercussions of human-induced climate change. Already, there's been substantial scientific progress in the last few years in attributing extreme weather events and their consequences to human-made climate change, said Francis Moore, a professor of environmental economics at the University of California, Davis, who was not involved in the new study. Professor Francis Moore added, "But an important caveat is that the consequences of climate change do not only operate through extremes. Changes in average conditions can also have large consequences for mortality, agriculture, worker productivity and safety. It may well be that the aggregate consequences of these changing non-extreme conditions constitute a large fraction of total climate change impacts." Professor Friedrich Otto called for a broader definition of what was considered as risk in climate change modelling, rather than simply sticking to hazards and impact. Other factors, such as the effects that extreme weather has on individuals, on labour productivity, on infrastructure, agriculture systems and property, should also be taken into account, he said. "We started at no one was ever talking about climate change, and now we've sort of moved over to blaming a lot of things on climate change, Professor Otto said. This is a plea towards realizing that that reality is somewhat messy, in the middle, and that we need to disentangle these drivers better in order to actually prioritize our adaptation and resilience building to really address climate change properly.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Press TV celebrates 15 years service with its anniversary July the 2nd, 2022. Television in Iran dates back to 1958, but even Islamic Republic broadcasting is over 40 years old now, as national radio and TV was reshaped in the very year of the revolution, 1979. So why establish Press TV all of a sudden in 2005 to launch it in 2007, especially when this channel operates quite differently from Iran's Persian language national or state TV? Well, with anti-Iran and Iranian Western propaganda rife, and U.S. and Israeli hostility in the region being sugarcoated by mainstream English language media, this country saw a vacancy. A vacancy for another voice, an alternative media channel. Can you blame it? With the media circus out there pulling all sorts of pranks on us. I'm Leila Faramarz. Press TV as alternative media started out with the motto News Anew, and following the same concept, it has continued as the voice of the voiceless by using satellite transponders and social platforms. This is in spite of sanctions and serious restrictions on its broadcast by Western service platforms. Press TV is for anyone needing to see the world through another pair of eyes, or for anyone wanting to tell a truth untold. Mr. Dabiri Mehr is a senior media researcher and assistant professor of political science.
Illustration and narration of world events are based on theory of pluralism. This is a fact. So the media world is dominated by a monologue. When something happens anywhere in the world, most media narrations of the event are similar. If these narrations are based on reality, there is no problem. But if you make a case study and investigate the issues, you find out that the narrations are sometimes very far away from reality. In this situation, we see the emergence of some media that offer a different narration and try to provide a narration which is close to reality. I stress that they try to do so, because it's almost impossible for any media outlet to absolutely reflect the reality.
No TV channel provides equal coverage of all matters, and Press TV is no exception. But if you're watching mainstream media, you've got to balance it out with alternative media. Western audiences particularly could do with a narrative taking off from this region related by the people of the region. The region Western governments love to come force democracy on, as if that's possible, democracy by the boot. I'm talking of the need for a narrative by those who know, for instance, how and why Israel really came about and how it's terrorizing Palestinians and breaching UN resolutions. The entire social media is either owned or dominated by Zionists, as is the mainstream corporate media, as stressed by Dr. Kevin Barrett. He's an American author and journalist. It's not hard to believe him, looking at the Islamophobic, Iranophobic content of social media. So how can we do without alternative media sounding the other voice?
Although social networks claim to be completely independent, in practice you see that they are acting in accordance with the general policies of the United States. That is, they implement policies that don't conform to even their own instructions and laws. When the U.S. government gives them orders, they easily follow them and disregard their own regulations to create restrictions for countries and governments. In this case, we also saw a similar pattern.
As for the channel's Iran focus, well, seeing as mainstream Western media will make a mountain out of a molehill if Iran makes a mistake or if it is accused of making a mistake while glorifying their own government's crimes against this country and region, Press TV introduces the Iranian perspective of politics as well as Iran's achievements and natural beauty while covering current affairs everywhere. As a viewer who's also a media professional, what's your take on Press TV content, say the Iran focus?
As a viewer living in Iran, I'm very much attracted to Press TV shows about this country. For example, I remember watching a couple of programs regarding a school for the deaf and an Iranian dish. They really attracted me. But for the foreign audience who are used to hear bad things about Iran from the mainstream media, I can imagine that it would be hard to believe. So I believe that Press TV needs to work hard to present the reality and to thwart the mainstream media efforts.
Since 9/11, Western bias has divided the media into two camps, purported Press TV at its onset. The Western camp and the one they claim supports extremists and al-Qaeda. Press TV came about during the U.S.'s round of supported retaliatory attacks on regional countries, Afghanistan then Iraq. Because by the invasion of neighbors, Iran was automatically being encircled by U.S. forces while its peaceful nuclear program was coming under attack. Now, it hasn't been easy to carry on, but Press TV has fought tooth and nail to do so, given the emergence of media diplomacy and its determining factor in shaping minds.
Using the media as a diplomacy tool is experiencing a challenging period. The reason is that the audience or the public opinion doesn't feel good about media independence to the ruling system. For example, if CNN viewers are told that the channel belongs to the White House, they no longer watch it. If the audience feel that Al Alam, a new channel, belongs to Iran's government, they won't watch it again. That will be the same regarding Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera and other news channels. Therefore, today, the media that have at least some levels of independence succeed in having an impact on the audience. I say relative independence because no media have absolute independence. It's not feasible, it's a dream. All media have levels of dependence to their owners and policymakers.
The democratic world, as we knew it, has been cracking down on Press TV and Iranian broadcasts pretty obviously since 2012. I'll mention some instances briefly or in depth to show the ludicrousy. How the democratic world has so blatantly infringed this country's freedom of speech and voicing the voiceless is a matter to ponder on.
When there are no reports about Israeli atrocities and what transpires in countries like Yemen, there won't be any sensitivities. But if the information is reported accurately, people will question their governments. The U.S., which is usually behind such crimes, will have to be accountable. We are aware of the crimes the Israeli regime has been perpetrating over the years. The reports are being broadcast by the Islamic Republic's media. Naturally, the U.S., which is Israel's biggest supporter, won't accept this and works to prevent the information from reaching other people.
On January the 20th, 2012, Press TV's license to broadcast in the UK was revoked by Ofcom, the UK's media regulator. This was on the grounds that the company's editorial content and control came from Tehran. Press TV and its partners argued London offices of CNN International, Bloomberg and Al Jazeera all ultimately answer editorially to bosses in Atlanta, New York and Doha. Also, if real editorial control of the station was from Tehran and that was a problem, it would have been a problem also when Ofcom's license was first granted. Press TV maintained Ofcom's decision was a clear instance of censorship and the channel continued to broadcast in the UK via its YouTube and Facebook pages.
We're all familiar with the contradictions within the liberal democracy. People in London used to have access to your channel, Press TV, and the number of viewers there were growing fast. They couldn't tolerate this growing number of viewers and had to stop it by revoking the channel's permit on the basis of falsehood over some alleged complaint of a journalist who's detained in Iran, which of course doesn't have anything to do with that. It doesn't come as a surprise then. They try to impose limitations on any of our media that are influential around the world.
In early April 2012, the Munich-based media regulator BLM announced it was removing Press TV from the SES Astra satellite for having no license to broadcast in Europe. But Press TV produced documents showing it could broadcast under German law. And Munich's administrative court announced on June the 15th of the same year that the ban was illegal. The ban, in other words, was based on false premises, no subjective misjudgment even.
In the past few days, the anti-Iran terrorist group of MKO had a meeting and they had a live broadcast of the event. The MKO was even on the list of the U.S. terrorist groups, but everybody knows that they were removed from the list in a politicized move. Now their leaders take part in the meeting and they are given the chance to broadcast the event. They even don't allow the non-mainstream media in their own countries to have an impact. They tamper with Google search and other search features to crack down on alternative voices. For us, a tangible example that outraged even those who criticized the Islamic establishment is what happened when a terrorist attack was staged by Al-Awaziya group in Ahvaz. At that time, the mainstream media refused to describe the attack as a terrorist or criminal act. If a similar attack happens in another country, they are quick to call it a terrorist attack, especially if the attacker resembles Muslims. They don't even wait for the police to confirm the terrorist nature of the attack. But when it comes to Iran, even though Iran's foreign ministry condemns it as a terrorist attack, the mainstream media refused to call it a terror attack.
Years later, beginning 2019, Press TV has found itself on and off social media platforms, more than once a year even. In April 2019, Press TV reported that Google had blocked its access along with Hispan TVs without prior notice, citing violation of policies without explanation. No explanation came as no surprise to Press TV as it believed it had not violated any of Google's listed policies. This station accused Google of censorship, as Google owns YouTube.
International unions and international NGOs are amongst those that can play a role in restoring the rights of Press TV. In order to restore Press TV's rights, we should avoid relying merely on governmental mechanisms and entering direct quarrels with the companies that have switched off Press TV's satellite broadcastings. If we do that, we'll lose our audience. Imagine that we spent 3 years negotiating with one of those companies in order to get back on Sky satellite. There is no benefit in doing so and will only lose time. I think the solution is to circumvent official channels. Today, the world and communities do have such a potential.
In 2019, Twitter deleted thousands of accounts it alleged were associated with the Iranian government. This was before it admitted it never saw the CIA startup report that led to the ban. In January 2020, YouTube deleted the Press TV UK channel, which hosted hundreds of videos and boasted 28,000 subscribers. That was days after the US killing of Iran's top military leader, Qasem Soleimani. This suggests the real motive behind censoring Iran was to silence its inconvenient truths. It wasn't the first attempt by YouTube, but it was permanent.
As I said before, such an incident shows that the media outlet has had its influence and has been successful to some extent. But I have a reservation. This shouldn't be a justification for the TV channel to engage in costly and low-benefit challenges. If there is much at stake, there is no problem to fight for it. You present a just argument, broadcast a special documentary, and reveal a hidden reality. In this situation, it's worth paying the price, but you need to act more cleverly to prevent the enemies of Press TV from joining hands. In the world of media, we have sometimes paid heavy prices for a low-benefit measure. After reviewing Press TV's function over the past years, I recommend that we shouldn't give any excuses to those who block freedom of expression.
Facebook shut down Press TV's page without prior warning. That was on March the 26th, 2021. Again, it wasn't the first time, but this time it was to be permanent, although Iran Today is back on now. Facebook at the time gave no explanation for its action and no right of appeal to Iran. The American social media platform DID did, said it banned Press TV for failure to follow Facebook community standards, but it didn't specify how Iran's professional English news network might have violated its rules. Besides, its so-called community standards are pretty shady and hard to follow. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Plenty more to face Facebook with. But first, a quick media review to see what other outlets have said. Here's how it looks on the page. Proving the importance of alternative media, Inside Arabia reads, Saudi Arabia funds news platform to deliver more propaganda to Americans. A Saudi government-funded news platform underway in the U.S. will deliver only more propaganda to an American public already drowning in a sea of political lies, disinformation and conspiracy theories. According to recent foreign lobbying disclosures filed with the Department of Justice, Saudi Arabia has plans to introduce a new digital news platform based in Washington, D.C. In fact, Saudi Arabia funneled more than $27 million U.S. dollars into influence operations in the first year following the death of the U.S.-based journalist Jamal Khashoggi, according to filings in Open Secret's Foreign Lobby Watch database. The vast majority of this lobbying spending was targeted in the U.S. towards elected lawmakers, influencers, think tanks, traditional media, and social media platforms. A New York Times investigation found that the Saudi government had employed a spy to work inside Twitter to help track dissidents like Khashoggi online, while also deploying a troll farm to go swarm their posts and pages with threats and smears. Moreover, this news platform, a term used to describe the venture and the filing documents, comes just as the Saudi government has hired a new crop of lobbyists to curry better relations and favors from the Biden administration and U.S. Congress. From Oxford News, we've got social media manipulation by political actors, an industrial-scale problem. Professor Philip Howard, director of the Oxford Internet Institute and the report's co-author, says,
Our report shows misinformation has become more professionalized and is now produced on an industrial scale. Now more than ever, the public needs to be able to rely on trustworthy information about government policy and activity. Social media companies need to raise their game by increasing their efforts to flag misinformation and close fake accounts without the need for government intervention, so the public has access to high-quality information. TheReason.com reasons the opposite is true, too. There are those in America who know and want to tell the truth. Correspondents stifled, for example. Here's a good case. Julian Assange's case is a frightening omen for press freedom. World journalists have been quicker than Americans to see danger in prosecuting the WikiLeaks founder. While the ordeal of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange elicits grudging reactions from many an American journalist who finds him distasteful, his pending extradition to the United States, just approved by the British government, spurs protests around the world. In countries not blessed with a First Amendment, advocates of free speech rightly see Assange's years-long persecution for exposing U.S. government secrets as an attack on transparency and a threat to anybody who embarrasses powerful officials. Comfortable seat warmers who are cozy with the powers that be may hesitate, but real journalists battling censorious politicians recognize Assange as one of them. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel has signed an order to extradite Julian Assange to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years in prison on charges linked to WikiLeaks, publication of information in the public interest. Paris-based Reporters Without Borders, RSF, noted on June the 17th. The organization described the decision as a failure by the UK government to protect press freedom and will have dangerous implications for journalism around the world. That'll be it for the news section.
Facebook indeed was stepping on the First Amendment's freedom of expression. It's a big feat for a social media company to undertake single-handedly.
Although social networks claim to be completely independent, in practice you see that they are acting in accordance with the general policies of the United States. That is, they implement policies that don't conform to even their own instructions and laws. When the U.S. government gives them orders, they easily follow them and disregard their own regulations to create restrictions for countries and governments. In this case, we also saw a similar pattern. I have been studying Facebook's terms and policies. There isn't a single article that Press TV hasn't adhered to. In fact, the channel's account has been complying with those exact terms.
Here it is. Facebook claimed Press TV had violated its community standards by disseminating hate speech, truths about Israel, perhaps. Whereas Facebook seems to have no problem with America's homegrown terrorists and crazies.
The same goes for freedom of expression. They let bomb-making tutorials for Iranians be circulated, but don't accept the smallest move that would go against liberal democratic thoughts and immediately take the page down. They don't allow the photo of General Qasem Soleimani to be published, but there are tens of accounts belonging to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. How can they explain this contradiction?
To look at Facebook's own report card, rather than serve as a social media company, it has acted as a data mining company. How it helped decide the US 2016 presidential election outcome was that it let information on its users to the highest bidder. Cambridge Analytica, in this case. That was the political data firm hired by Donald Trump's election campaign, which was given access to information on 50 million Facebook users. Information on their likes and dislikes and friend networks. Knowing of their likes and dislikes meant knowing how to target them with digital ads to affect their vote. Time to unfriend Facebook, read a Newsweek edition.
Over the past decade, when we saw the dominance of social media, the business performance of Facebook and to less extent Twitter have been good. They were successful trade companies, but their business red lines are so strict that they have retained them at the expense of freedom of expression, transmission of information and human rights. It's not just about Iran, Press TV, the Third World, Arab countries, Muslim world or the Middle East. This has also happened for the the American people. Those companies are based in the United States. If we want to make a list of these companies' violations, it would be a long one. They don't care about offering the reality. What they care about are their stocks and the value of their companies.
Press TV's former CEO, Peyman Cebelli, has called for a parallel pressure campaign with Russia, as RT, Russia Today, has been under threat too. It was in 2018 that RT's Nikolov and Press TV's Cebelli signed a memorandum of understanding for cooperation in Tehran. That would be to take joint media and legal action against censorship crackdowns by the West.
Well, the first thing is that we anticipate what they want to do. When this foresight is there, we can take immediate action in case it happens. Fortunately, there are two important facets to the cyber world. The first is that there is a huge amount of information in circulation, and control, censorship, and other actions that would stop that flow aren't feasible. But they can monitor our data, and because there is no center to the internet, there is no command, and that's what enables us to relaunch